made by speculating aggressively. And the attraction of critical minerals is, it appears to me to be the single best place in natural resources to speculate with money that you could afford to lose some of, and speculate with money that you have the psychological ability to endure the volatility around, and you have the psychological ability to wait 3 years or 4 years or 5 years for your payoff. But it's the sort of place where I see $50,000 investment turning into $500,000 or $750,000 or $1 million.
Rick Rule, good morning to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm fine. The better for being on with you and talking to your audience through you. Thank you.
No, you're very welcome. It's always a joy and pleasure to spend some time with you. So we have a bunch of things I want to cover, but let's start out with is just what's all in the news. It's gold ripping, and I believe that's just due to, it looks like the economy is slowing down with some data that were coming out, and the gold is sniffing that out. So give me a 30,000 foot view that you can on the macro and the economy and why gold's ripping here.
Well, a couple of comments. I would suggest to you that gold hasn't ripped yet. People like the move, but as we discussed the last time you and I talked, Andy, gold really started moving in the year 2000. It was at $250. Now it's at $3,000, so it's up 12-fold. Gold has done its job. It's increased 8.5% or 9% compounded for 25 years, maintained your purchasing power. I suspect that that move accelerates now. I don't think it accelerates necessarily because the economy is getting softer. It accelerates because people understand that as the economy gets softer, that the Fed's only mechanism for dealing with the economy getting softer is lowering already artificially low interest rates and quantitative easing. In other words, it isn't the disease necessarily that's moving gold. It is fear of the so-called cure that the government will employ.
Well said. Well said.
You know, what is interesting to me in all the geopolitical tension that's going on is that, you know, Trump has said as an example that we benefit from a weaker dollar. That's been a policy of the Japanese for 70 or 80 years, an occasional policy of the Chinese. Gold seems to me, Andy, to be the only medium of exchange that doesn't have a domestic political constituency for devaluation. The powers that be in the United States, not the U.S. consumer, by the way, but the powers that be in the United States would like a weaker U.S. dollar. In order for Canada to compete, they need a weaker Canadian dollar. They've been achieving, by the way. The Europeans need a weaker euro. The Chinese need a weaker renminbi. The Japanese need a weaker yen. It's a surreptitious tax that governments can put on their citizens, that the citizenry doesn't react too well and doesn't get to vote on. And I think gold benefits from that because gold doesn't have any constituency for devaluation.
On all of that, you know, it's yes. And then it's like the obvious, I think, is like when you have a strong currency, money flows into the country, correct me if I'm wrong, and then everything would benefit. But no, that's not what the powers that be have in mind.
No, and you know, and bringing it back to gold, you are hearing in the press about the fact that inflation is stubbornly high, even if you measure it incorrectly with the CPI, at the same time that you hear about an economic slowdown. We had a word for this in the late 60s and early 70s. It was called stagflation. Most of your audience probably isn't old enough to remember stagflation, but sadly, I remember it like it was yesterday. And during the period of the 1970s, it will be interesting for your audience to know that according to the Office of Management and Budget, the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar over those 10 years declined by 75%, which meant that $1,000 in 1980 bought $250 worth of 1970s goods and services. Not coincidentally, Andy, bringing it back to gold, during that period of time when the purchasing power of the dollar fell by 75%, the gold price escalated 30-fold. Now, I'm going to suggest to you that the first tripling of the gold price from $35 to $100 was more a response to deregulating gold and the incipient inflation that built up in the decade of the 60s. But I would suggest to you that the move from $100 to $400 or $500 was really a function of the deterioration of the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar. Mm-hmm. And that the last $200 or $250 was momentum buying when gold went from being out of favor to in favor. The point of all this is that people are concerned about stagflation. That historically, one of the responses has been gold. And if I'm right about the unserviceability of $100 trillion, pardon me, in off-balance sheet obligations and $36 trillion in on-balance sheet obligations, with a slowing economy and with persistently high inflation, this feels to me like a rerun of the 1970s. And one way that somebody could protect themselves, protect their family's purchasing power, is precious metals and precious metal securities.
Yes, and I share your thesis, just about all of it. And I would really say your thesis is not a feeling or an emotional one. It's really based on a lot of data. So, what I'd like to do about gold, and again, we discussed that because it's in the news, and that's just what we do. That's what I do. And two things I do is I follow you and I model a portfolio off of hard assets, specifically gold. And so it's really hard not to talk about it, but I do want to pivot a few things and two sectors that I'm very interested in. And as a matter of fact, I sold some gold holdings in the last 2 weeks. I lightened up some. I was really overweighted, but I'm really sniffing around to two different places. One is the critical minerals area, which I think are undervalued, significantly undervalued, and the other is the energy space. So I'd like to discuss with you about that. But before we go there, I want you to talk about your conference coming up. And just, I asked about this because I've benefited significantly from your conference in the past. I sniffed out a couple of companies there that were at your conference, and I made a lot of money. So tell me about the conference again. I'll put everything in the show notes so people could go to that and learn more.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, first of all. The conference is, I'm reliably informed, 30 years old. I can't remember the first one, to be honest with you, although I'm also informed that I put it on. But let's talk about what the conference is. First of all, it's a community of people around natural resource investing. We don't try to be all things to all people. We don't talk about annuities. We don't talk about crypto. We don't talk about pot stocks or tech. We talk about natural resources, and we've talked about it for 30 years. And there's a core of attendees that have been coming for 20 years or more. The idea that all the knowledge in a conference emanates from the dais out to the audience is stupid. If the audience is comprised of hundreds of wealthy people who are interested in making and preserving money. So that the conversations that you have at the conference are as important as the conference itself. It's important to note that. But the conference itself is the best natural resource conference on the planet, separate and apart from the attendees. Here's why. Our big picture thinkers, our macro thinkers, aren't commentators or journalists for the most part. They are people who talk about various components of the economy because they're from there. In a biblical sense, they're from the belly of the beast. Our political keynote speaker this year is David Stockman. David Stockman ran the Office of Management and Budget in the Reagan years, the first, if you will, Department of Government Efficiency. He wrote a great book called The Triumph of Politics, where he described the political derailment of the Reagan Revolution within 6 months of Mr. Reagan's inauguration. He's recently written a book entitled How to Actually Cut $2 Trillion from the Federal Budget. There is nobody who knows more about the budget And nobody who knows more about debt and deficits than David Stockman. He's not a journalist. He's from the belly of the beast. He was the originator, if you will, of the Department of Government Efficiency. Naomi Prinz will be there talking about the structure of Wall Street, not as a journalist, but rather as a woman who was a partner at Goldman Sachs. She witnessed the structure of Wall Street from the belly of the beast. Daniela DiMartino Booth talks about the Fed, not as a journalist, but rather as the head of research for the Dallas Fed. Again, from the belly of the beast. Jim Rickards comes to us, talking about leverage and the nature of Wall Street in that regard. He comes to us as former general counsel of long-term capital management, whose failure almost brought down Wall Street. It's important that you differentiate macro commentators from people who participated and saw it from the inside, and people whose experience is limited to being undergrad students in a journalism school before they went to work for some publisher. Huge, huge, huge difference. Once you have your worldview shaped by players as opposed to by journalists, then we move on to portfolio managers. Our portfolio managers are people that have been active in natural resource investing for 3 decades, not youngsters who failed at technology and failed at consumer durables and were put into small portfolios where they couldn't do any damage, but rather people who have invested successfully in natural resources for 2 or 3 or 4 decades. Then we move on to the living legends, probably the most important part of the conference. The living legends are individuals who have built multi-billion dollar natural resource companies from scratch, talking about how the conjunction of macro and capital markets allowed them to build fortunes, explaining in very concrete terms their successes, their failures, and how it made them, and more importantly, how it can make you a better investor. How do you spot the entrepreneur who can grow a market cap from 25 million to 5 billion? Critical skills. Andy, at my conference, our exhibitors are content too. At every other conference I know, the exhibitors are just advertisers. Qualification to be an exhibitor is a check that cashes. At our conference, public company exhibitors have to be owned in accounts owned and managed by me. No guarantee, unfortunately, that every stock I buy goes up. But there is a guarantee that my team has studied those companies very, very, very thoroughly before they get me to part with some of my hard-earned money to buy them. In other words, at our content, because our attendees have told us so, our exhibitors are content as opposed merely to advertisers. The process is very, very honest. Similarly, the bullion and coin dealers at our conference are people that have been in existence for 20 or 30 years in the business, where I never received one complaint about them in the process of building up a 250,000-person customer base at Sprott or a 275,000-person customer base at Everbank. In other words, they're vetted. We turn down more exhibitors every year than we accept at our conference because the requirement that we have is that our exhibitors are content too. All of this allows me to say to attendees, if for any reason, whether you attend live or via live stream, that you don't think that you got your money's worth, solid gold guarantee, I give you your money back. The financial risk is all mine. By the way, in 4 days, and you know this, Andy, you were there. In 4 days, we're going to give you 50 hours of programming, which is more than you can absorb in 4 days, even if you do everything right. So you have access to the conference recordings, whether you attend live or via live stream. And you'll need access to the conference recordings to get your money's worth out of the conference, to get your time's worth. You'll have to attend live or live stream for 50 hours. And then you'll need to replay the recordings at least once, preferably twice. Because we're going to give you an unbelievable amount of information over 4 days. And as I say, if at the end of reviewing that information, you don't think that I give you your money's worth, I'm going to give you your money back. I've been doing it for 30 years. All of my financial education products have this complete money back guarantee. I'm very proud to say, Andy, over 30 years, I've had to refund less than 0.1% of the tuition I've charged. But that's my guarantee to your listeners. Satisfaction guarantee.
Okay, so that's great. And I'm going to just give my 2 cents on there. Thank you for that. And I went last year. I was a media sponsor. Rick invited me. I'm talking to all my viewers and listeners here. Just invited me to come. I made a lot of money at Rick's conference last year. But I'll tell you what really stood out to me. Not only did I get to spend some time with Rick, I got to spend time with Nomi Prinz. I got to spend time with Danielle and DiMartino Booth. I interviewed them there and I hung out for drinks on the cruise that you had. I had some off the record conversations about the economy. I got to spend time with Jim Rickards. So that was incredible value. But then I got to spend time with all these other people, the attendees, and just their thoughts. And just you're, again, around a lot of people that share a love and passion for this. And so you're picking those brains as well. So,
well, you know, Andy, that's an important point. People who think like us are relatively rare in society. And to be able to hang out with 500 of them live or 1,500 of them online is worth a lot. I had an attendee years ago, I think, email me and say, Rick, to follow first Robert Friedland and then Bob Quartermain around the exhibit floor and see what booths they stopped in front and eavesdrop on the questions that they asked was worth the price of admission. I got the whole rest of the conference for free.
All right. Yeah. By the way, that Rick knows this, but to all my listeners and viewers, that happened to me and Rick. Rick doesn't remember this, but I followed him around like a puppy dog 30 years ago. It just would mirror whatever booths and people and companies he was talking with. So, but okay. So I'll put all of the links to that. I highly recommend it. And it that in not selling it too lightly, it's you should go. If you are interested in this space, you absolutely should go. Let me go back to, I sold some gold positions. If we come back, I'll add in them again, but I have a great core here. I have no regrets there. But what my thesis and my theory here, this is just portfolio management, is to add some energy and critical minerals. I'm very interested in both. And what I actually did is I went to your conference page and I'm looking at some of the names and I'm throwing in them in there with some other names that I'm evaluating. But some of the names I'd love for you. Well, first comment on critical minerals and let's talk about one company that I have in mind. What is the outlook and what is your view on critical minerals and why investors should be there?
Well, I love the critical minerals business precisely because it bores most people. They aren't paying attention to it. And the way we live today, our ability to talk to each other through the computer and see each other, our ability to utilize the phone in every aspect of our life. Technology itself is a function of critical minerals. And I believe is that life is going to continue to get better, government notwithstanding, and consumption of critical minerals is going to increase. Meanwhile, there's increasing geopolitical competition around critical minerals. The development at hope, the intended monopoly on supply chains by China, as an example, and the West, that means that critical minerals are going to be ignored less in the future, which is important, but they're ignored now. I like that sort of thing. I like the sort of investment proposition that nobody cares, but people are going to care, and that the answer to the unanswered question begins with when, not if. We know that there's 2.5 billion people on Earth who don't have enough money to employ very much by way of critical minerals in their life, who are going to be able to employ more in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And we know that all of us are going to be able to employ them. True. They're called critical for a reason. And the fact that people don't care is extremely appealing to me. I think that 5 years from now, people will care a lot. And I think that 5 years is an appropriate time for an investment. So if I can buy a world-class deposit of critical minerals, not an also-ran, but a world-class deposit, one that will be globally significant, and I can buy it at a price that reflects the fact that nobody cares right now, and allocate capital for 5 years, and come into the period where A, it isn't a deposit anymore. It's about to be a mine. And we go from people not caring to people caring desperately. That's the stuff that 10-to-1 returns are made of, or 20-to-1 returns are made of, or 30-to-1 returns are made of. And a lot of my life has been spent searching for 10 baggers and 20 baggers and 30 baggers. Andy, I joke that all the money I now invest conservatively, I made by speculating aggressively. And the attraction of critical minerals is, it appears to me to be the single best place in natural resources to speculate with money that you could afford to lose some of, and speculate with money that you have the psychological ability to endure the volatility around, and you have the psychological ability to wait 3 years or 4 years or 5 years for your payoff. But it's the sort of place where I see $50,000 investment turning into $500,000 or $750,000 or $1 million. I've been lucky enough in my life to have that occur numerous times. And I, despite the fact that by now I'm 72, I'd like to have it happen again. And I think it happens in critical metals, rare earths, stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm glad that you said that too about critical and rare earth. I'll throw that in there, minerals. I just see such a huge lack of investment, if you would, right here. And as you said, it's boring, which is a great bullish sign that nobody cares about it. And so that's really where you want to be. And if I'm going to talk to my listeners and viewers here, I'm teeing this up here for you. We got Rick on sharing his thoughts. Use that as in your toolbox. Then we have the conference, Rick's conference, which you need to go to that. That's teeing it up. And then I'm going to name drop some companies here. And this is how I found the companies. I found them on the symposium, the 2025 symposium site. So I'm just teeing it up for all you guys. I do not own these companies as of yet. Full disclosure, that will more than likely change over the next several weeks as I do my own due diligence. And this is a great starting point for you to start doing due diligence. So Rick, talk to me about Hot Chili. They were at your conference last year. I was evaluating them. I did not buy them. I bought some other companies and I'm looking at them very strongly right now. And I got them from your conference. Talk to me about them.
Hot Chili is in the copper business, as its name suggests. I hate the name, by the way. As the name suggests, it's in Chile, the country Chile, which is the world's dominant copper producer. I'm attracted to Hot Chili for several reasons. One, the young CEO, Christian Easterday. 20 years ago, nobody went after these concessions because they were government controlled, and nobody believed that they could get through the Chilean government to get control of them. And Christian didn't much care what other people believed. He basically camped on the door of the ministries till he got control of these projects. Took him 5 years, but he did it. Persistent, harassing. Most new copper deposits in Chile are high up in the Andes, in nosebleed country, like 5,000 meters. These, by contrast, are on the coast. 100 meters or 200 meters. Most deposits are very, very remote. These deposits, the Pan American Highway goes through. Power lines go through. Water lines go through. There's a town that people live in that mine copper. That's important. This is probably, as a camp, the 10th or 12th largest undeveloped copper field in the world. Like size, that's important to me. And there's a separate aspect to it. Given that water is extremely scarce in northern Chile, one of the constraints to development was water. And the management team worked for 20 years with the Chilean government to get a marine concession for desalinization. This is becoming both a copper company and a water company. I don't know what the water's worth because I haven't seen a preliminary economic assessment or a feasibility study on the water aspect. But the truth is that they have a water resource granted to them by the government in the driest place on the planet. What's wrong with Hot Chili? One thing. They don't, as of yet, have a high-grade starter pit, despite the fact that this is 10th, 11th, 12th largest copper deposit in the world, a vast copper field. At present, they haven't discovered a place where the copper-rich fluids that impregnated the now host rocks ran into rock that was prepared enough, porous enough, that they precipitated out in high-grade copper. The average grade on this thing is about 0.5%, which is not inconsistent. The average mine grade worldwide is about 0.5%. But to have a great copper deposit, you want to have some 1% or 1.5% copper, so that in the early years, you get quick recoupment of capital. And what's missing with Hot Chili right now is that. I am confident that with, I think it's 11 exploration centers in this camp, that they will discover a place where enough fluids concentrated and precipitated out, that they will find that high-grade core. If I'm wrong, I have a problem. That's the great unanswered question. If you don't know an unanswered question, by the way, if you don't know what the principal unanswered question is, you do not know enough to speculate. And the principal unanswered question at Hot Chili is, where's the starter pit?
Do you have an ETA or have any idea when they'll figure that out?
Oh, I only wish. I only wish. I'm 12 years and counting.
Got it.
I've been treated well, by the way. The size of the prize is enormous. The icing on the cake may be the water, but the catalyst is the starter pit.
All right. We'll stay tuned. So they're on my list. I am not an investor yet, but that might double change or might change and shortly here. So I'm very interested now in energy, deploying some capital and energy, specifically uranium. I love the sector and I love that it sold off. It went to hated to euphoria, really, in the matter of, 3 to 4 years. And now it's almost hated again, but probably, I wouldn't say hated, but bored. People are bored with it. So a lot of the cream or a lot of the froth has been taken out. Comment to me about uranium. And then there's a uranium company, Homeland Uranium. Again, I got them from your site. They caught my attention because they are new. I haven't seen them around. To comment about why do you like them?
I like the uranium sector generally, because I look at increased utilization for uranium around the world, and I don't know where the material is going to come from. I like it more specifically because uranium is the only commodity in the world that I know of that's developing a term market, a market where both producer and consumer is liberated from the spot market. I love the fact that a uranium company with a deposit that they can put in production can pre-sell material and use that pre-sold material, provided it was sold to an investment-grade counterparty, to obtain the financing necessary to build the mine. This doesn't happen in any other commodity in the world. I just love that. And I particularly love the fact that now that the companies are 50% cheaper in the world, we're in a 50% off sale. People hate it. That's ironic. You know, coming into summer, they had a 50% off sale on swimwear or boats. The merchants would be packed. We're coming into summer. There's a 50% off sale on uranium stocks, and people are disgusted, I guess, because they own them already. I think that's wonderful. And judging from the opinion on Twitter, or now X, while we aren't hated, we're certainly a capitulation. People who were extremely aggressive posters, aggressive to the extent that their handles on Twitter included uranium in the handle, are now abandoning it. This is personal capitulation. It doesn't get better than personal capitulation. So I like your instincts around uranium. Homeland Uranium, I own, not because this is the biggest uranium deposit or group of deposits in the world. It's because it's a team that's been in the uranium business for 30 years. Business has been so sketchy that competent teams of that duration, particularly duration with experience at places like Cameco, the biggest uranium producer in the world. Those are scarce. This is U.S. uranium, which shouldn't matter to me. But in an area of increasingly tense geopolitics, it's weird in the United States, Andy. I've gone in 5 years from being hated and vilified for being interested in uranium to the point where now they want to subsidize me. Now, I need to say, I felt cleaner when they hated me.
Right.
The truth is that if they take my cost of capital, parenthetically, Homeland's cost of capital, sub-zero, well, that means as a shareholder, my return on capital employed should be very high. The group of people behind Homeland Uranium are people I've known for a very long time. They're good capital markets people. Properties are well-known properties. Their exploration thesis is very concurrent with what you would have to do to beneficiate these properties. At the macro outlook, both around uranium, but also around U.S. uranium, is, I think, a theme that doesn't play out over 5 years. It plays out over 2 years. And from my point of view, 2 years is a fairly short time frame.
Yeah.
I wouldn't construct a speculative uranium portfolio around one company. I think that you need to say, this is an amount of money that if I were wrong, I could afford to lose a third of or half of, in hopes of probably, as opposed to possibly, making 500% or 600%. And I think that you need to construct a portfolio of 3 to 5 names, with Homeland being constituent in that, as opposed to placing all wine eggs on one early stage basket.
I'm very glad that you mentioned that. And to give you some feedback, we have a common friend, John Fennick, and we talked about you recently. What's the Rick Rule rules, if you would, pun intended. And, you know, you buy a handful or two handfuls of these companies, you're going to hit it out of the park on a couple, or one to two. Couple are, you're going to go nowhere, and the other ones are going to go BK, or you're going to lose all your money. But as a whole, you're going to make up for all of that on your long balls. So I can't.
It's important that you note the arithmetic around speculation. As you point out, if you make 10 decisions, 6 are probably wrong, but likely you don't lose all your money in those 6. If you follow the lessons at the Rule classroom, what you learn is that when the reason to own a stock goes away, the stock goes away, win, lose, or draw. So rather than losing 100%, you lose 20% or 30% or 40%, not pleasant, but manageable. Because if you get one 10 bagger, that amortizes more than all of your losers.
Yeah.
Particularly if you make a little bit of money or break even on 2 or 3. The arithmetic around speculation is that your upside is unlimited, while your downside is limited, and you can manage your downside. You know, you'll remember, I think 3 years ago, I liked the exploration thesis around Chicana Copper. Mm-hmm. Great people, great exploration concession, copper oxides all over the place. You know, the best indicator mineral of copper is copper. It copper everywhere. And they had 3 different exploration ideas. I took a big cut at this thing. If I remember correctly, it had a 4 million Canadian market cap. And I thought if they were successful in any one of the 3 ideas, they'd have a 40 million market cap. And if they were really successful, it could have a 100 million market cap, which is a lot of fun from 4 or 5 million, you know? Well, they drilled the ideas and they were 0 for 3, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you paid for the stock. If the reason to own the stock goes away, the stock has to go away. I have a big position there, so it's difficult for me to liquidate it. But the truth is, if the reason to own a stock goes away, at 30% down, you sell it. At 40% down, you sell it. At 50% down, you sell it. At 60% down, you sell it. That's what you have to do. The way that exploration arithmetic works is that when the reason to own a stock goes away, you're absolutely ruthless on the sell side. But on the upside, you keep reviewing the news, and to the extent that the news keeps getting better, which is to say, to the extent that the underlying stock is more valuable, you don't trim your winners anywhere near as fast as you trim your losers. It's tempting if you've lost before, if a stock goes from 25 cents to 75 cents. Now, if it does it on no news or muted news, of course you sell enough to recoup your capital. But if it goes from 25 cents to 75 cents on great news, you have to reassess the value proposition. It may be it's relatively a better value at 75 cents than it was at 25 cents. That's part of exploration arithmetic too. That's the lesson we try to teach at the Rule Classroom. But it's important that you invest, first of all, in your own education before you speculate in the market to understand how exploration arithmetic works. John Fennett gets it. You know, he's been around a long time. He understands that you press your winners and cut your losers, and you do it based on a fairly sober assessment of the math.
So let's talk. We got one more company, but before we go to that last company, let's talk about the Rule Classroom that I'm a big fan of and what you offer investors there. Again, we're trying to give all my viewers and listeners as many tools as they can to succeed. So tell us about that. Then we'll go to one last company.
The Rule Classroom is really an outgrowth of a course I did with the Colorado School of Mines years ago called the Mining Investment College, which Colorado School of Mines and David Galland sold for $1,000 a copy. We're trying to duplicate that for free, which is a much better price than $1,000 a copy. The Rule Classroom has, 40,000 subscribers, but it has 10 or 12,000 people who work hard. By work hard, I mean there's 9.5 hours of instructional programming and probably 150 hours of other forms of programming. Most weeks, there's a free question and answer session, absolutely, positively free. There is a subscription component too, a paid component. That's fairly small. I think we have 1,000 paid subscribers. But the truth is that if you go to the Rule Classroom, you utilize the how-to lessons of the Rule Classroom. And in particular, if you participate in the discussion groups, where there's a lot of smart people, and attend the free question and answer sessions most Thursdays, you will become a better investor. You just flat will become a better investor. You will be competing against people whose investment criteria is, quote, got a hunch, bet a bunch. And after you learn the techniques and you learn to master your emotions, you absolutely will positively will outcompete other people. It's absolutely free, ruleclassroom.com. As a feature of the Rule Classroom, you get my monthly newsletter for free. Every month, we deal on one particular topic. We just did oil and gas, where we distributed the letter, and then we had a free oil and gas investment question and answer session at the Rule Classroom. We talked about 11 companies, not merely as recommendations, although I own all 11. But in every case, we talked about the investment merits and how they fit into a portfolio. So rather than giving you stock tips, in every issue, I give you a company I own and why I own it so that you can consider for yourself whether or not you should own it.
But I will put the link in the show notes. Let's pivot a little bit here to a royalty company. Again, I pulled this royalty company off of the 2025 Rule Symposium website, a sponsor there. And it's kind of nuanced. I had Rob McEwen, who we both know, I had him on recently a week ago, and he kind of surprised me. And it was a great interview. It was fantastic, full of wealth and knowledge. And he's going to be at your conference this year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Or I'm wrong. Yes.
Rob's been coming for 15 years, bro.
I didn't see him last year, but I saw him this year. That's why I bring that up. But it was a fantastic, one of the most enjoyable talks I've had since you But I'm saying that he surprised me. He's not a fan of royalty companies, and I don't share the same idea. He has a different take on it, and I don't, by any means, this is not a criticism of his. He's a very, very successful investor. Give me your idea on why you like royalty companies, and then let's talk about Elemental Royalty Company and why you like them.
I like royalty companies because they're so predictable. And their margins are so. It's important to segregate between royalty and streams. Most of them are housed in the same companies.
Yeah.
A royalty gives you a certain amount of the minerals produced on a concession over time. And a stream gives you the right to prepay for a certain amount of a product over time. In both cases, the royalty company or the streaming company, the owner of the royalty or stream, isn't responsible for the upfront capital cost to build the mine. They aren't responsible for the operating cost to operate the mine. They aren't responsible for sustaining capital investments, which is to say, other than on a stream, the amount that you agree to pay by contract for the material, your gross is your margin really is a function of the commodity price at the time with no extraneous factors. That means that these are much, much, much lower risk activities than operating or exploration companies. It also means, ironically, because they are so efficient, because they're such high margin businesses, that as the commodity price increases, their margins increase less rapidly than less efficient companies. And that makes perfect sense. If you are a royalty company, let's say you're Franco-Nevada, and you have a 5% net smelter royalty on all of the gold on the Barrick part of the Carlin Trend, your margin at $3,100 gold is $3,000. If the gold price goes to 4,000, your margin only goes up by 25%. If you are Schlepp's Schmuck and Schmo production company, and you're producing gold for $2,500 an ounce and selling it for $3,000. In other words, you'll enjoy a $500 margin. If the gold price goes from 3,000 to 4,000, your margin tripled. Now, at 72 years of age, having been speculating and investing in cyclical businesses now for 50 years, you can take away some of my upside, Andy, if you take away all my downside. That's why I like the royalty and streaming business. I also find that the people who populate the royalty and streaming business as investors, but also as managers, tend to be more financially astute. And I like hanging out with smart people.
Sure. Well, tell me about Elemental.
Elemental was the result of a merger between two predecessor companies with capital from one of the best private equity investors in mining, a group called La Mancha, the people who, among other things, funded Endeavor Mining in Africa, hugely successful people. The predecessor companies were an African exploration company called Altus, where I was a founding shareholder, and Elemental Royalty, which was a construct of London Financial Markets. The idea being that you took the technical expertise and the royalty generating experience of Altus, you provided the financial wherewithal from this wonderful Egyptian entrepreneur behind La Mancha, and you combined that with the financial acumen of London Financial Markets. Turned out to be a great success. And I'm pleased as punch to have them at the conference. It's a wonderful, wonderful amalgam of intellectual capital in a small cap market cap with definable competitive advantage. To the extent that they have the opportunity that's too big for them to swallow in their own balance sheet, with access to London capital markets and also with access to La Mancha, a $1 billion capital pool, they can say to the seller, not we're confident we can raise the money. They can say, here's the money.
Right.
With, in particular, their technical range of experience in Africa, they have the ability to acquire royalty and streams that other people would never see because they've been on the ground in 15 African countries for a very long time. And because they have access to London capital markets, they understand how to talk to the financial services industry, the institutional investor, and they have the financial side of the financial technical marriage. It's unusual for a company with that market capitalization to have that many boxes ticked.
Got it. Well, to all of our viewers and listeners, Rick and I just went over three different asset classes. Correct me if I'm wrong. We went over the gold market. We went over critical minerals, which I really wanted to hit. And then energy in the form of uranium. I am disappointed. I wanted to discuss, but we'll leave this for next time. Gas and oil. That's where my background is. I believe that's where you cut your teeth in it as well. but we'll leave that to next time. Any thoughts on, and we also gave you three companies. So again, a lot to work with, meaning three companies to start doing due diligence with. Any parting thoughts here as we're going, coming out of the springtime and going into the summer?
Well, I think we're coming into a 5-year period that's going to be good for the whole range of resource and precious metals companies. I remain concerned on the one hand, which is to say for society, but confident for myself that despite the real attractiveness of gold, it's underowned. Less than 0.5% of total savings and investment assets in the United States are denominated in precious metals or precious metal securities. The 4-decade mean is 2%. If demand for precious metals merely reverts to mean, demand for the stuff grows fourfold. And I believe that the macro environment, which is to say the likelihood that the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar declines by 75% over the next 10 years, the same way it did in the decade in the 70s, means that rather than gold going to 2% market share, it goes to a higher number. That's attractive to me. I'm not suggesting that your listeners should take their portfolios to 50% gold. I am suggesting that any of them that don't have their portfolio at 2% gold are probably taking risks with their family's purchasing power, and they should revisit that. I think, too, and we'll cover this the next time you and I visit, that while the big thinkers in the world think that peak oil demand occurs in 2030, peak oil demand likely occurs in 2065 or 70. When people value companies, they do them on a net present value basis. And if you begin to run down the net present value in year 2025 and you run it out to 2030 and then chop it off after that, you cut the value of the oil company precisely in half. And I think that the oil industry as a whole is selling for half what it's worth. I like buying stuff at 50% off. I particularly like buying stuff at 50% off when they're generating so much cash that they can maintain their basic business while buying back stock and paying me a decent dividend. This suggestion that I have to choose between yield or growth when I could have both is attractive to me. So I hope that helps. And then the last thing that we talked about a bit is the boredom around things like rare earths and critical minerals. The fact that they're out of favor means that there are some fairly small companies that have deposits that are potentially world scale, deposits that will be in the best cost quartile in their commodity category worldwide, in the highest return on capital employed category worldwide, and that have $15 or $20 billion or more in in situ value at current commodity prices. And you can buy these companies at fractions of what their net present value will be upon the delivery of a feasibility study. That conjunction of virtue is almost the textbook definition of how you enjoy 10 baggers or 20 baggers or 30 baggers. And despite the fact that I'm old and fat and bald and rich, and I don't need a 20 bagger, I want some more desperately.
Me too. So those last two points were fantastic. And that's why I'm sniffing around in critical minerals and uranium right now. But on your oil and gas, what you just said, I just had a discussion with the Canadian oil producer just recently. Nobody knows about them here that we're talking about. And it's exactly what you said. They're paying a very healthy dividend, and then I'm participating on the upside.
Right.
Think about that, guys.
Your risk is personified in Carney, the new prime minister of Canada, like the old prime minister's anti-oil. So we've identified the political risk. You need to decide something about the political future of Canada. If the political future of Canada is even stable, the Canadian oil industry has survived and thrived in 10 years against a prime minister who hated them. pretty amazing. If the new prime minister is a bit more pragmatic, and particularly if President Trump allows greater U.S. distribution capabilities for Canadian hydrocarbons, I'm not saying it's going to happen. If it does happen, the lid gets blown off this stuff. Absolutely. And I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I think that people need to look at the upside as well as the downside.
Yeah. Yes.
One more thing, if I might, because I always forget to do this. Any of your listeners who like what I have to say should personalize it. They should go to my website, Rural Investment Media, list your natural resource stocks for free. I'll rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst, and I'll comment on individual issues if I think my comments might have value. Given that this is absolutely free, no obligation, 2 enjoys a money-back guarantee. RuralInvestmentMedia.com, please no pot stocks, please no crypto, please no tech stocks, natural resource stocks only. I look forward, of course, to seeing you. I look forward to buying you a beverage of your choice on my boat cruise. And I look forward to as many of your listeners as can possibly attend, either live, which I would prefer, or via live stream, remembering that in either case, they'll have access to the recordings, which they'll need, and also understanding it comes with an absolutely pure gold, no conditions, money-back guarantee, if they're not completely satisfied, either live or live stream.
Excellent. I will put all of this, all of it in the show notes so people have easy access to this. Rick, you just become a friend to me, and I consider you that I have the highest amount of respect for you. I love our talks, and to all my viewers and listeners, you guys are really just, you're getting a treat. I just hope you understand that you're getting a treat. I hope to see all of you guys at the 2025 Rural Symposium. Again, click on the link to get there. Thank you, Rick. I do so much. I'm grateful for you and your time.
Thank you. And I look forward to our oil and gas talk.
I'm looking forward to it myself. Have a good day. Great.